You're listening to Ain't the Right Radio, the official podcast from Orzopedia.com, your community source for Final Fantasy XIV. And now, your hosts for Ain't the Right Radio, Aniro, Fusion X, Kahlo, and Stake.
Hello, you're listening to Aetherite Radio, the official podcast of Orzopedia.com. I'm Aniro, and joining me today, Fusion X, as everyone will remember from last episode, as well as some newcomers to the show, Kahlo, as well as Stake. How's everyone doing today?
Good. It's really good.
Pretty good. Yep, pretty good.
Excellent. Well, we're very excited to be back for our second episode already. Some very exciting stuff happening out at GamesCon 2009 this year. Final Fantasy XIV being shown off in a grand capacity, and in fact, a playable alpha build was available out there this year at GamesCon. So very exciting stuff happening out at GamesCon. But first, a few things that I wanted to mention. You can contact us at our email address, podcast@orzopedia.com. We've also got the forums going on over at orzopedia.com, so make sure you check that out. Lots of great articles, lots of great information floating around from GamesCon. Some of it we're going to talk about today. Some of it you're going to want to go to the website to check out.
Absolutely.
So make sure you check out orzopedia.com. One thing I want to mention before we get into everything here, I checked out iTunes today, and boy, was I surprised to be a part of the iTunes Top 20. So we really want to thank the great response, the great community response that's come out for us. So thank you for your ears, and we hope that we'll keep you coming back here to Aetherite Radio.
Absolutely, and thank you for all the feedback in the forums, too. We've had a lot of positive feedback, so shout out to all you guys posting in the forums and letting us know what you think of the show.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. Now, Kahlo and Stake, you guys weren't able to join us for the first episode here, and that may actually be kind of par for the course as far as Aetherite Radio is concerned. We've got a staff put together here, and we're really excited about being able to bring you a diverse staff full of lots of different opinions, lots of different points of view, and lots of different backgrounds. So, Kahlo and Stake, I want to welcome you both to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, you know how it go.
So lots of exciting stuff to talk about. Fusion, why don't you give us just a general idea of what we saw out at GamesCon this year, man?
Well, you know, we heard about 14 was going to be at GamesCon. You know, there was like a list that had come out and said it was going to be like live on the floor or something. Everyone's kind of like, what's going on with this?
And that was a surprise announcement there.
Right. You know, because you're thinking, okay, it's going to be on the floor. It's like, they can't have, like, something for us to play. That would be, you know, they just announced this at E3. Like, you know, a couple months later, they're not going to have anything playable. Sure enough, they're like, hey, alpha build, here you go. And we're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, holy cow.
Very awesome.
Absolutely.
Lots of cool information. The alpha build, you know, it's alpha. It's not even beta. They have a long way to go yet, so there's, you know, some simple things like menus weren't there, but the core purpose of the alpha build being playable at GamesCon was to show off the Guild Leaf system. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking a little bit about the user interface, the kind of action system they have set up, you know, as well as a couple of other things that we got out of some interviews from GamesCon. So,
yeah, absolutely. Very unique ideas being applied here to Final Fantasy XIV. And, you know, we did a lot of speculating on the last episode, and it seems like Chin had made a really good point that, you know, we can sit here and speculate all we want. Whatever they're going to come out with is, in the end, going to be a lot more surprising and a lot more innovative than we ever thought, and I think that a lot of us are starting to realize this with a lot of the announcements made out there at GamesCon.
And even now, like, you know, this is alpha build. Things could still change. We could, you know, be talking about, you know, the user interface and, you know, all this stuff, and it could be totally different down the line. You know, it probably won't have, like, drastic changes, but, you know, there's going to be some changes here and there between, you know, the alpha build at GamesCon and, you know, when the game launches. So
it'll
be kind of curious to see what exactly they tweak with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think the UI right now is probably the thing most likely to change a little bit.
And I think that that's the thing that's getting a lot of the scrutiny from a lot of this press at the moment. You know, just the thing that we're able to concentrate on from a lot of the video, from a lot of the pictures that we've seen, is that you know, we've been able to get a really good look at the Alpha Build UI, and hopefully, you know, that's going to be able to provide at least a little bit of preliminary feedback to give Square Enix an idea of where they need to build the UI. And of course, the beta process is going to be a very, very important part of building the UI. So, you know, that's also something to be considered here in the near future. So, you know, there were some interesting talks out there, even about the possibilities of when we're going to be able to see a beta and an open beta. No definitive timetable set yet, but some ideas that they're going to be. It looks like they're going to be coming at least relatively shortly with a closed beta. So, definitely interesting stuff there.
We'll hit that at the end of the show too.
Yeah.
Because we're hoping that our next episode will be after TGS, so we have kind of an idea of you know, what's going to happen between now and TGS, so we'll hit that up and let you guys know what's going on, and just, you know, hopefully, you know, pray that the beta comes out sooner than later here.
Yeah.
So we'll give you some info about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, some of this info that's been coming out has been some interviews that Famitsu had conducted while out there, especially with specifically Sage Sundy, as well as Hiromichi Tanaka, both giving interviews to Famitsu.
This was actually the first time that Sage Sundy has been involved with any kind of Final Fantasy XIV stuff.
Yes.
He was actually, some of the pictures you may have seen from Gamescom, he was actually on the floor while people were playing the Alpha Build, but it was kind of revealed, and I think, you know, everybody kind of assumed this anyway. He's going to have the same position with 14 that he does on 11. He's going to be that kind of, you know, bridge between the users and the developers. He's going to, you know, head the special task force, or, you know, any kind of anti-RMT activities, as well as GM services.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing that he had pointed out during an interview with Famitsu was that he said that community relations and special task force are just going to be expanded versions of the ones that are currently in place for 11. So, you know, they're going to tack on, you know, a couple people here and there, but it's, you know, at the core, it's going to be pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's something that I'm actually really excited to hear about, because what you have here is obviously everyone in the FF11 community and all around knows Sage Sundy. He's someone that, you know, we're familiar with, someone we trust, and the fact that he's going to be heading up the same department in 14 is something that it's good to look forward to, you know, instead of bringing in someone new who maybe hasn't had the same kind of experience or hasn't dealt with the community that Sage Sundy's used to.
And absolutely.
The same thing can go for, you know, the community relations and special task force groups too.
Absolutely.
You know,
you
still have all the people that have all this experience. You know, you get, you know, some new blood in there to, you know, and they'll end up just falling right into place with all the, you know, all the experienced people on the team. So I think that'll work out really well.
And for as different as Final Fantasy XIV is going to be from 11, from a development and a management standpoint, there are undoubtedly similarities. And just having that previous experience. And I mean, you want to talk experience, man. You talk Hiromichi Tanaka and Sage Sundy.
Oh, absolutely.
And even a lot of the other peripheral members of the development team, they have long histories with, you know, Square Enix and developing games for them, and you know, Sundy even going back as far as Ultima Online for you know, community relations. So I mean, you've got the experience, and you're absolutely right, that is a very positive thing for Final Fantasy 14. So definitely some good stuff there.
Yeah, and one thing that Sundy wanted to make sure to point out too is, just because they're going to have the same people, you know, working on it, it's going to be, you know, expanded, but, you know, essentially it's going to be the same people,
right?
You know, in charge of, you know, what they are for 11 on 14. He says that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't going to be any kind of differences between the games with, you know, those different areas.
Sure.
One example he gives is, you know, they're working on the ease of contacting the GM. You know, whether that's something they're looking at for 14, you know, it's kind of like if they make it easier in 14, shouldn't they apply that to 11? It's kind of like, you know, it's
maybe they'll
it's
just have like a GM button on the user interface. You just press it and it just you'll pops get a, there.
They'll,
and just like,
they'll send
boom.
You a Square Enix keyboard and it has a big red button.
Well, yeah, and that's definitely one of the things that goes into, you know, why I'm so excited to see that, you know, the same teams are heading it up is because they already know a lot of the problems that, you know, they're probably going to face in 14 because of 11. And they can start working to correct those or be prepared for them. Whereas if you brought in a new right. team, they have yet to identify those problems and work to fix them.
Yeah.
And another great thing to look at too is, you know, for example, you know, the GM thing, depending on, you know, how they're planning to make it easier, it may be more difficult to add that into the pre-existing system in 11.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
when you
that's
look at 14, they're still making it. They can throw it in there, and it's a lot easier. So that's something else to consider, I think, too, when they're talking about, you know,
step one, increase the number of characters you can put in the reasons why you're contacting the GM.
Yeah, that may help. That may
give
help.
You like four letters. It's like,
reason why you're calling a GM, just to talk.
Yeah.
I'm lonely.
I wanted to talk to a GM.
Just wanted to say hey.
I just wanted to say
but you know, there were some interesting notes that that Sage Sundy gave about you know, about what kind of community landscape we may see with Final Fantasy 14. And one of the things that we don't have with Final Fantasy 11 at the moment are Japanese premiere sites. There are no Japanese premiere sites for Final Fantasy XI like there are with the North American and the European ends of the Final Fantasy XI community, and that's something that that Sage Sundy addressed in a few of the questions that were asked. So why don't we talk about what Sundy is thinking at least, you know, for the future of the Final Fantasy XIV player community.
One thing he said right off the bat is that they want a premier site system for 14. They've said they're not going to have official forums in any language.
Right.
You know, there was in one of the things that Corinth had posted up, it was revealed that I guess there was a Japanese forum,
at one point,
during beta. But that ended up getting kind of closed, and that's kind of why, you know, the Japanese players feel like they don't really get, you know, that was kind of a slap in the face for them, because it's like they have, you know, this one connection to Square Enix to try and communicate, and then it gets closed. So, you know, we always complain about communication and stuff, but we, you know, we've had things like the podcast tour and stuff, and the Japanese players, they look at that and say, what the heck? You know, where's our stuff like that? But, you know, a big part of that, I think, is that they don't have premier sites. And I think, you know, by doing this, what they want to do is they want a, you know, premier sites for each, you know, each language or each region. And then they're going to be getting feedback via those premier sites, much like they do the premier sites for Final Fantasy XI.
Well, and I think the first step in doing something like this is we need more than just the page on Play Online where, you know, it lists five or six of the current, you know, community sites or whatnot.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If we had like an actual site that was dedicated to documenting and keeping up on community sites such as, you know, Pet Food Alpha, Limit Break Radio, JP Button, and things like that. If there was one site that sort of helped to bring all them together under a collective, you know, umbrella for Square Enix to look at, and obviously for other players in the community to go to find exactly what they're looking for, that would definitely help the community come together immensely.
Oh yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and they're looking to kind of bring a new shape to the community for 14. You know, compared to, you know, 11, it's going to be, you know, the communication is something that they want to improve.
Yeah,
And I think, you know, one thing we can look at already is not too long ago, it was just, you know, last month they had upgraded the kind of community site page for Final Fantasy.
Yeah,
11.
They sure did.
It was a couple months ago, and you know, that could be something that they were like, hey, you know, we have these ideas for 14. Maybe we, you know, we should probably upgrade the 11 stuff or vice versa. They did it for 11. They're like, this is really good. Let's take this.
Yeah.
Take it over to 14, maybe even improve on it. And so I think that'll be really good. You know, they talk about things like, you know, blogs and personal sites. And they actually have said that they want to do a site that's kind of grown out of the efforts they've made with the Flingshell community beta site, which is, I think that's still in beta, isn't it?
I think technically, yeah, it is.
I think Gmail is still in beta too, for what that's worth. But That's something that they want to do with this, you know, the 14 LS community site kind of incarnation that they're making, is they want it so that, you know, players can, you know, tie personal websites and stuff like that. And I think, you know, we will probably see some similarities with the current community site system we have for 11 with that. So, let's see, what else do we have here? They are not looking to have regional servers at this time. A lot of people are like,
I say amen to that, like, really.
Like, there's really two sides, like two strong sides
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
One that's kind of like chilling in between. Like, I'm not sure where I want to go. It's like people with pitchforks on each side. Like,
Yeah. There seems to be a lot of people who have made this issue to be a very heated one. And I think that a lot of the desire for regional servers is coming out of Japan. At least that's where I've seen a lot of the sentiment from. Right. I mean, granted, you know, I haven't really been too up on what the community buzz about regional servers, you know, has been. But it seems to me that, you know, a lot of the North American or European players are kind of like, you know, whatever. And it's a lot of the Japanese players that have really been pounding hard for the regional servers. And I mean, again, I mean, I'm a fence sitter. I think, you know, I've had great experiences with Japanese players. Mm-hmm. And I've always, I mean, I've always had fun, you know, when I've played with them on Final Fantasy XI, and it's always been a really positive experience. But then again, we've all heard horror stories too. So, you know, again, I from my own personal experience, I don't see what the big deal is. I guess that just kind of naturally puts me in the middle, makes me a fence sitter. So,
well, way that I see it too, when you talk about those horror stories, we don't just have horror stories, you know, about European players or about Japanese players. We have those same ones about American players too.
Oh yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So
oh,
it,
yeah.
It, I don't think that, you know, when it comes to, you know, horrible experiences, that should be something that's put under the, you know, this is why we should have regional servers. But there are certain perks and then, you know, certain downfalls to having regionals or having not. Like, for example, the fact that we don't have regionals, anytime you log on, there's going to be a substantial amount of people.
Yeah, there's going
to
be someone
to play with.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas maybe if you had regional players and you want to, you know, find a good time to farm when there's less competition, well, now you just have
to pick 5, 6 a.m. Right, yeah,
exactly.
Now there's nobody on.
Like
right.
that. So definitely both sides have their ups and their downs to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And one thing to look at, too, you know, after Outer Gone came out, they had Besieged.
That, too, and, yeah, you know, which is a mass
hours
battle.
Of the day where
yeah.
it's like no one in North America is logged in, but
well,
the Japanese
yeah.
players are logged in so that they can, you know, kind of take care of that. You know, and you know, we don't know if they're going to have anything like that for 14 or not. But you know, just having something on a server that could kind of, you know, be made to happen whenever. And I think, you know, no matter, you know, what language you speak or what, you know, what country you're in, I think there's people that are on both sides of the fence. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of, I'll be curious to see, you know, what, you know, what will eventually happen, but it looks like they like the idea of global servers. And I
yeah.
think, and I honestly, I think that's something that makes Final Fantasy or the online games for Final Fantasy in general really unique, because
absolutely, yeah.
a lot of the online games now are their servers per region.
Mm-hmm. And when you actually, you know, take a look at, you know, the games that Square Enix have produced against, you know, other games, if you just look at the entire infrastructure, you know, Final Fantasy, it has types of PvP, but as we've, you know, said in previous shows on both PFA and LBR, that it's not centered around PvP, and you're not out to gain just for yourself. You have a group
right.
of people who are helping you.
Right.
And I think the fact that we don't have regional servers and it's, you know, global, that sort of helps to promote that overall arcing feel of the game, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, I think that that the at least for the majority of the lifespan of Final Fantasy XI, that it was a game that encouraged and even forced you into group play
mm-hmm.
and made you communicate with other players. And I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to, I mean, because, you know, I've played other online games, and there are serious community problems.
Oh, yeah.
With I mean, you know, you get a game as large as World of Warcraft, you start to have community problems. You have people that have serious attitude problems, and that, I mean, you know, yeah, you're not always running into them, but it tends to make a game not fun. And I feel like, at least in Final Fantasy XI, that those experiences, those negative experiences, are so few and far between that it's hard to even consider it as strike it up in the con mm-hmm. category when you're mm-hmm. weighing the pros and cons.
Well, yeah, and that's what you know, that sort of the way that Square Enix and Final Fantasy XI have always been, is they promote that unity between people, you yeah. know, between Absolutely. Cultures. And I, you know, I'm like you, I'm on the fence. Like, if they said, you know, we're switching to regional, I don't think that I'd make a big fuss about it. You know, I'd still play the game. It wouldn't be that big a deal. But I would definitely put my bet on the fact that they're not going to do that, because really, I think going to regional servers is against their nature, you know?
I agree. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a black and white issue. I think that you can have you know, several servers that are segregated by region and have the majority of servers be mm-hmm. global servers. I think that could be a viable option as well, and maybe something that they could consider too. But you know, there is this big discussion, and you know, I'm not sure how much of it is really warranted on the show, just because, you know, there seems to be a whole nother perspective to this argument that we're just not going to be able to get with our opinions and our points of view. So maybe that's a discussion better left to another episode or to another day.
And I do believe that there is a forum thread right now too on Ors about languages and servers. I think it's in general discussion if you want to keep an eye out for that. But yeah. I mean, it's there's definitely, you know, lots of discussion to be had about this subject. So.
Sure. Oh, yeah. But, you know, we didn't just find out about what to expect, you know, with the community end of things, although that was a nice surprise. I wasn't expecting any information regarding community aspects. Hell, I wasn't even expecting a playable alpha build.
And
so,
you know, I think
so.
That,
Gamescom
that
was very exciting. So,
yeah, and that you know, that the whole point that they're even mentioning community now, I think that's a great
yes
kind of thing. It's like they're already thinking about, you know, getting, you know, like fan sites, community sites involved and stuff. I mean,
absolutely,
you know, 'cause
yeah.
this is. You know, I would have thought that maybe we'd hear about this, you know, just a little bit before the game came out mm-hmm. or, you know, around beta. But, you know, to have it, you know, them talking about community just a few months after they even announced the game, I think that's really great.
It's forward thinking. Win.
Right. And you have to also, you know, remember that it wasn't until this past year that, you know, the community sites really started pushing for that type of interaction with Final Fantasy XI. And it didn't seem like we were getting very far. But the fact that they're starting out 14 with that in mind is definitely yeah. extremely promising.
Absolutely.
I agree. So we did find out a fair deal about the actual game itself. You know, we speculated a lot about a great deal on the last episode. And if you haven't checked it out yet, I highly, you know, recommend hearing the discussion. A lot of the ideas were very interesting and very unique, whether they come to fruition or not. You know, still very, very interesting ideas. But one of the things that we found out a little bit more about with this show off of the, you know, the demo is that we found out a little bit more about the Guild Leave system. Some very interesting stuff connected to that. It seems as if the Guild Leave system is going to be one of the central aspects to Final Fantasy XIV.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it that way, it's like, you know, you have Guild Leaves is to 14 as, you know, Assault was to Otter Gone.
Yeah.
It's this, you know, really big part of it. And, you know, even today, people are still, you know, getting in there and doing a lot of assaults.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure Nizel helped with that quite a bit. But, you know, it's definitely going to be a really big part of the game. They've come out and they said that, you know, they're working on a lot of different leaves for players to use. And they're going to be adding more in version updates as, you know, as the game goes on. So that'll be really cool. You know, lots of different little quests to do and stuff. So.
Yeah, exactly. The Guild Leave system reminds me a lot of how other MMOs have handled doing quests.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas in FF, it was more of a realistic type thing. Like, hey, this person wants me to do something. And, you know, you have your little quest tab hidden away in your menu there somewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have no objective trackers, nothing that really tells you exactly what you have to do.
Right.
But it seems like they're taking a more traditional approach to it this time.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily to their detriment either.
No, of course not. Not at all.
You know, I think that they tried to play around with that formula with Final Fantasy XI, and there were things that worked about it and things that didn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that a critical component of the Guild Leave system that should be considered is what kind of progression, what kind of character or story progression are you going to get out of doing Guild Leaves?
Right. But what I see they're aiming to do here is, you know, like, again, with quests in 11, you did them. And you got stuff for them sometimes.
They were generally mediocre rewards.
Right, but...
I have these two pieces of rock salt. Thank you.
Exactly. Jeez. Whereas, you know, if you wanted to actually, you know, progress further, get levels, you had to go out and do one thing, and that was party. Whereas with, you know, Guild Leaves, and the way that it seems they're using the direction here is it's helping you get two things done at once. You know, you're increasing your skill with your weapon, but you're also making progress, whether it be getting rewards or, you know, whatever it is. You're doing more than just one thing at a time.
Absolutely. One thing we did talk about on the last episode was that we did know that we could carry multiple leaves with us. However, there will be a number limit placed on that.
There is a cap, yeah.
Yeah, there's always a catch, you know. One of the points that they made when they were talking about this was, you know, even if you can only carry a couple with you, you can still do leaves with other people in your party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you won't get the end reward, but you'll still be able to get skill ups and you know, that kind of thing. So if, you know, you're planning a night out, say, okay, I'll get, you know, these leaves, you can get these leaves, you know, we'll alternate or whatever. You'll get your rewards, I'll get my rewards, we'll both get skill ups. And I think that's not too bad.
It's a system that does encourage group play, but also leaves room for solo and small group play as well. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that a lot of these leaves are going to be a varying difficulty, and, you know, some leaves would probably require maybe, you know, I don't know where I'm pulling this from, but maybe a party of six players.
Right. And it also said in the interview too that, you know, so there are certain leaves that you could, you know, do on a daily basis, whereas other ones, which are, you know, more difficult, may take several days to complete.
Yeah,
right,
that's quite a time frame. It's like, well, this one could take 30 minutes, this one could take a couple days. Yeah. And another thing, too, I want to mention, and we're hoping to get this article up on Orzopedia here in the next week or so. You know, now that we have all the images from Gamescom, we got to go and look at them and, you know, see what
analyze
exactly they're trying to show us.
Do our CSI magic and, you know, pull up, you know, a little piece of the corner GUI and see what it is and blow it up. Yeah, no.
I got the whole, like, the arm with the, you know, several magnifying glasses that overcoats the monitor.
As but, he dips them into, like, the blue watery stuff.
Like a Terry Gilliam film.
There you go. Yeah, I actually print out the screenshots, put them on Litnitz paper, and no. One of the things that we did get a screenshot of was kind of one of the screens for the Guild Leaf quest. It looks like you can open up a window and you can select the leaf you have and, you know, choose to start it. One of the things that is listed on here is, you know, skill, which is probably your skill. Like, you know, starting out, if you're probably not going to have a lot of skill.
Yeah.
They talk about the issuing city. Again, coming back to this idea that you're going to have different leaves per city state.
Mm-hmm.
They give a starting location. They tell you the time limit, leave requirements. There weren't any in this case, so we don't know exactly what those will be. One interesting thing that we really don't know a whole lot about yet, it says BP cost 10.
Hmm.
So, you know, just right off the top of your head, you're like,
blood metal?
Battle points?
Battle maybe? Points. I don't know.
So it's almost wondering if you have to, you know, kill stuff on the field in order to get BP to get Guild Leaves, which would, you know, instead of just doing Guild Leaves, you know, nonstop, you actually have to, you know, like, take a break, you know, go kill some mobs, come back, you know, we don't know what it is.
Gotta earn it. Gotta earn that leave.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, hopefully it's not, you know, something where it's like, okay, you get this amount of BP per day or something, kind of like assault tags. Because once, you know, Salvage came out and they introduced the Nisal Isle Assault, people are kind of like, well, crap, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Assault kinda points to get in, you know, and get into Salvage, and you don't get those from Nisal, but you still use tags, and yeah, it's just, it's this whole thing. But they also have rewards on here. This one mentions 2,000 gil and a high potion.
Yes.
Woohoo!
All right.
Yeah.
High potion.
Yeah, man. Woo. Right off the bat, getting high potions, man. I remember in 11, I found an NPC. It's like a potion. It's like 900 gil. It's like, oh my god. I have like 50.
Stupid adventurer coupon.
Yeah.
Trade the adventurer coupon.
Yeah, exactly. And
then,
yeah.
The last thing it mentions too is the objectives. You know, so it's like for this case, it's you need to eliminate this amount of, you know, enemies or whatever. So
right, and you know, it's something that Square Enix is kind of well known for is that when they show off something, I think a great example of this would be Moblin Mazemongers when they showed that off at the 2008 Fan Fest. They don't really like to show you the fully fleshed out version of what they have. They kind of, you know, here's the bare bones, here's a monster, this is kind of like what it's going to be like, and then they release it, yeah, and it's like, holy crap, this is totally different than what, right, you guys even described, and way better too. And so, I mean, yeah, I've got to believe that the Guild League being a central part of this, what they showed off there was very, very, very basic.
Yeah, and even then, you know, if you compare it to Moblin Mazemongers that we saw at FanFest, I think all the tablets, you know, no matter how you set them up, it was like an elemental boss or something.
Yeah,
right.
It's kind of like, it's like that's not a Plantoid, and I put the Plantoid rune in there. What's going? That's an elemental. But with this one, for the alpha build, they said that they actually had three different leaves. And we don't have any more information on the other two at this time. You know, hopefully some more stuff comes out about that. Maybe not, but, you know, we'll definitely post something up if we do find anything. A couple other things to mention here about Guild Leaf, is Tanaka, I believe it was, mentioned that the final build is going to provide you general locations for monsters involved with your particular active Guild Leaf.
Oh, so you have no idea how awesome that is.
So if you have to, like, kill dodos or something, you open your map, and there's kind of like a circle or something. They're like, yeah, they're hanging out around here.
Yep. Everybody gets wide scan.
Well, yeah, yeah. And that's definitely like, you know, if you've played other MMOs that have, you know, quest type objectives, you know, such as, you know, go and do this thing, and you spend, you know, 3 hours looking around for where this,
right,
is.
Yeah.
Finally, you get online and you look, and you're just like, oh. And you,
like,
feel like such an idiot.
The cave. Dude, it was like, I'm on right the tallest, next to me, rockiest hill in the world. There,
yeah,
could be a million caves here. It's,
yeah,
like,
exactly. Geez. Yeah. But that's, I mean, that's going to be good. That's something that I think was a little bit lacking in Final Fantasy XI. And so, you know, sometimes to you know, complete a quest or complete a mission, mm-hmm, a lot of it was left up to dat miners.
And, well,
so
yeah, and it's really nice to see that they're providing us, they're still giving us a challenge, but they're also providing us with smaller shortcuts that don't take away,
yes,
from it. Such as when you complete a guild leave, a crystal or whatever it was will pop up, allowing you to warp back to your Aetherite to turn that guild leave in.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't make it completely that easy because you still have to obviously, you know, trek out to wherever your objective is to complete it.
Right, yeah.
Right.
There is, travel is going to be important. I mean, one of the things, I think it was Tanaka that said this in one of his interviews, was that, you know, the Aetherite warps are not necessarily something you're going to be using all the time, and that foot travel is going to be also playing an obviously important role, but that most of the time Aetherite warps are used would be at the end of a guild leave. So, you know, it's nice to know that, they're giving at least some consideration to, you know, the way that you travel, because I you know, a lot of the frustration in Final Fantasy XI was, you know, you'd go out with something in mind and start out from Bastok and end up in Constant Highlands trying to, you know, solo from 8 to 10 or whatever and end up dead, warp back, and now you have to trek all the way back out there again. Or if you finish or fill up your inventory, you got to make the foot trek all the way back. So, you know, here's a different way to be able to address that kind of problem, especially early on. You know, early on in the game, I'm sure that that the Aetherite warps will be very important. And I mean, you know, hey, you know, you could end up out at a place doing an impossibly hard guild leave, and you know, when you finish it, it would be, you know, a very long walk back. So there's an easy way for that too. So, you know, that's definitely something positive right there.
Right, I agree. Okay, so also, talking about the action system, they say that there will be no auto-attack system in Final Fantasy XIV, which will be kind of different, because I think
most of all you melee that like to get in a party and space out, that's going to be a little harder to do.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult, because you won't be able to...
Man, I got
to
pay attention now. I can't just... Well, you know, it's kind of nicer, because they're not trying to make 14 as much of a, you know, grind as 11 was, so... You know, it's not like you're going to be sitting in, you know, like an 8-hour party, you know, it's like, okay, macro, engage, sit there, you know. So it'll probably be shorter parties, and you'll still be making, you know, a decent amount of progress and
right.
stuff.
Right. It definitely seems like they're trying to spice up the pace of combat a lot more. I mean, obviously, you know, different jobs usually have different timings. Like, you know, you're probably going to be a lot more active as a healer, whereas if you're a samurai, like, as everyone knows, you just sit there, you wait, meditate, weapon skill.
Right.
Wait, but if there is no auto attack, obviously, you know, you have to have a constant source of damage as any type of melee or damage dealer. So with all the different action buttons that they have down there at the bottom, you're definitely going to probably have a lot to do a lot of the time. So
yeah, and it's really interesting how they kind of work this in. During combat, what you're going to do is there's a action bar or command bar at the bottom of the screen. And as you're, you know, engaged to the mob, you have 10 commands that are on that are shown on the bottom, 1 through 0 on the keyboard. So you could probably select them that way. But what you'll do is you'll click on one of those, and you know, that'll be tossed up into what they're calling the action gauge. And then once your action gauge is full, you know, I'm not sure, it's probably, you know, a certain amount of time or something like that, it'll go ahead and execute whatever command you've loaded into it. I mean, this is a lot more, you know, involved than I originally thought it would be. You know, they've said that, oh, you know, we want to make it a little more active, and I'm like, okay. I'll be curious to see how they do that, but there's a
right.
lot of different elements involved with this.
Yeah, it's actually a lot closer. And if anyone, you know, has played World of Warcraft, they'll definitely recognize the action bar menu, the numbers 1 through 0
right.
from there. But the way that they're using this action gauge is definitely what sets it apart. Now, when you think about it in one way, the first thing that comes to mind is casting time. You know, when you first pick what you want to do, you have a little bar that you have to wait to fill up. But the fact that it's also something that, you know, every other class, such as melees and you know, damage dealers like that, are going to have, it definitely puts a whole new spin on things, while also keeping things different. Obviously, you know, casting magic and doing melee are two different things, but in a way, it's also making them a bit more similar. You know, it's kind of putting them under the same umbrella.
It's a much more active system, and I mean, I think that that one way you can kind of describe it, and I like your comparison to a mage, and I think that that there are going to be some similarities in the way that jobs are going to be played. Whereas, you know, with Final Fantasy XI, you have when you have a magic user, you have all sorts of different kinds of casting time, and that means different things to different classes. You know, for a black mage, magic bursting with ancient magic, you know, that's something that you have to time very carefully with, you know, with your magic timer. Same thing with like an Utsut Semi, you know, shadow cast.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that relies very heavily on timing and again, that sort of, you know, that timer gauge. And so to bring that over into the melee aspect and in fact to divide that between hands as well, I think that that's a very interesting concept right there.
Yeah.
The one thing that has me worried is, you know, obviously comparing to what things are like in Final Fantasy XI, when I think of myself playing Thief and having those 10 buttons, you know, I kind of think in a macro capacity, you know, what am
right.
I going to put on those buttons? And it's fine as a melee. And in fact, since I only have 4 or 5 things that I would use, it's definitely very exciting to think that I'm going to have that many more tools to try and fill up the spaces
sure.
that used to be, you know, just auto attacking.
Sure. Yeah.
But then when you think of it from a mage perspective, you know, white mage, red mage, black mage, they have a huge plethora of
yeah.
spells, and you use way more than just 10 spells.
Yeah.
And it seems like you're really limiting yourself, you know, unless there's a way to switch your action bar. Like if you have, you know, three different preset action bars,
well,
and there's ways to switch between them.
I think that may tie in well to the armory system, where when you change your weapon, you then have a different set of skills.
Mm-hmm. And one thing to keep in mind too, is they did say that they will be having macros in some form.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, the action bar will change when you change a weapon. If you're, you know, if you put on a staff, you're going to have magic in your action bar instead of, you know, sword or shield stuff. And, you know, I just limited it to 10 per weapon. Yeah. It's kind of like, so I would imagine that they would set something up where you can, you know, set up another bar to show it, you know, pop up.
Right. Or something. Yeah. And I know that, you know, a lot of us here aren't fans of the Blizzard game, but you know, I can't help but whenever I see the action bar, keep thinking back to how they do things. And there's actually ways on there to where you have your default action bar, and then you can set up, you know, four other ones around the outside. But there was in one of the interviews where they said that that there was just this one action bar and there wasn't ways to expand it, didn't they? Or am I imagining that?
I believe there's just one action bar.
Yeah,
right. Like if eventually they make it to where there's, you know, optional action bars, like, you know, you can go into options and be like, you know, show this extra one. Or even, as I said, like if you maybe hold down shift and, like, you know, press left
that,
or right,
that
it switches to another action bar.
That, I think, would probably be the more realistic, you know, option. Because it would just, you know, it would essentially just be like the action bar to me. It's like your macros, only they're always visible.
Right.
So you could easily just hold a button down and, you know, up and down, and it'll flip through them or something. And I think that's probably what'll end up happening.
Because it's really hard for me to imagine that there would only be up to 10 skills that you could use at a time for any given class.
Right.
There's got to be way more than that. I do believe
there was something mentioned, too, about how you have to pick your commands or something.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know, that just popped into my head. I'm like, oh yeah. So because who knows?
Did they mention anything? Because, you know, because obviously with FF you have your macros, but then you also have your menu where you can choose magic's abilities. And so I could see your action bar, similar to how macros were, being your main source. Like these are the main skills you use, but still having access to, you know, maybe secondary skills that you don't use as much that you would want.
So yeah, like
bar.
As a white mage, you could hit like divine seal on your action bar and then go into your menu and hit,
you know,
like a spell.
You know what I think? What I think it might have been from my understanding, what I actually saw, I think it was something where they want you to like pre-select commands before you go into something. So it may be, you know, just that, where it's, okay, you have, you know, 10 things on your action bar, and then you can access the others from the menu. It may not be
that definitely makes a lot
thing.
More sense.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It would be cool. Yeah.
Or depending on how long, you know, the lifespan of battles in FF14 is going to last, it could be something that they want you, you know, decide, are you going to need big cures for this fight? Are you not going to need big cures? Are you going to need, you know, skills that do spike damage, or are you going to need skills that, you know, do more smaller damage over a longer amount of time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, I hope it's really kind of, you know, as soon as you get into it and, you know, actually have the chance to tinker with it, it seems really overwhelming just looking at it and talking about it. It's like, man, you know, there's these gauges, there's the action bar,
there's the left hand,
you know,
the right,
I don't know
hand.
You know, we briefly talked about, you know, you guys mentioned the UI a little bit earlier and how, you know, a lot of things are going to change, but really I think they're on the right track with the UI, because like you guys say, there is a lot there, but at the same time it really doesn't seem like there's too much there. Like one of the things that Final Fantasy 11 has always had that I don't think other games have ever been able to do is when you look at screenshots for Final Fantasy 11, you see the game in some aspects, you know, it's hard to really tell that it's actually in the game, but whereas other places the UI is just so clunky and so overwhelming, you can tell.
You take a picture of WoW.
Exactly.
Like
it's like you know, you can't concentrate on the scenery and the stuff in front of you because there's all this, you know, junk and stuff around there. But the way that they made the UI, where there's, you know, they have all this stuff, but at its very minimum, you know,
it is
for your HP, you have a line and the number, and that's all you need. You don't need like a big border and then, you know, a blue background and then a giant fat bar that says your HP.
This time around, the biggest thing for them, you know, when designing it with 11, they had the PS2. And there are some things that they still need to keep in mind that they did when developing that UI, and that is that it needs to be controlled easily by a keyboard, a mouse, and a controller.
Yes.
All those three things need to be able to do everything that the other one can. you know, especially when you're looking at, you know, a controller versus, you know, PC type stuff.
And you know, one of the things that was said during the course of these interviews, and I'm not sure which interview specifically this was said in, but, you know, one of the things that you've got to keep in mind is that the way that they need, the way that they have to approach developing this game, inherently being a multi-platform game, is that they can't design it specifically for any, you know, it can't be too customizable for PC, because basically all the PC is and all the PS3 is just the shell that houses the software. The software has to be uniform between them in order to be, you know, 100% compatible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, again, that you're exactly right, Fusion, when you say it has to be compatible with keyboard, mouse, and controller. And, you know, they did that very well with Final Fantasy XI. And, you know, there, of course, there were, you know, especially on the 360, some of those menus were really big and kind of in the way. But, I mean, one of the things that you'll notice with this UI that they did, I think, really purposefully, is that, you know, they made a lot of it transparent and, yeah, and blends and really smaller. Well. Yes, and smaller.
But, and I think the thing, too, the big thing, is that now that they're getting away from, you know, the last generation of consoles, they can start to work with HD and bigger, better resolutions, so they, yes, can afford to make some of this stuff smaller. You,
right,
know, how any of this is going to work on a standard TV is, you know, remains to be seen, but, you know,
How many more standard TVs are there with, you know, being connected to PS3s? I mean, you know, you got to consider that, you know, a lot of people who have the money to go out and buy a $400 PSP probably have the expendable income to go out and buy a plasma screen TV.
But
as
I mean,
well,
you know, the biggest thing to look at is, you know, when 11 first came out, it was PC and PS2.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to stick with the lowest denominator. You got to go with, you know, work for the lowest one.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's PS2 with, you know, a standard TV connection. So this time around, you know,
what's going to be the big, what's going to be the minimum
PS2
specs?
Has, or PS3, you know, they got, you can put an HDMI cable right into it. So, yeah, you know, that is the lowest. I mean, you could, you know, the settings can vary, but you can do that right out of the box.
Yeah, and exactly, you know, with the PC version, you can have varying different settings of resolution as far as the UI is concerned. And I don't think that it would be unreasonable to allow for some flexibility with the resolution for the UI for the PS3 version either. That way, you know, if, you know, for whatever reason, someone out there who does own a PS3 and is, you know, still hooking it up to, you know, your average, whatever, you know, TV screen, can still have that option to be able to play, and it doesn't, you know, force those people out of, right, the potential, you know, the potential player base. So, you know, that's definitely something to be considered, and I think that that's, I mean, that's got to be something that they've planned for, at least discussed as a part of designing 14.
Absolutely. Going back here into the UI a little bit, one of the things that was mentioned was there was a power gauge.
The power gauge, yeah. Uh-huh.
And this was really interesting, because it was like, okay, we already know that you pick the commands and you know, they get kind of thrown onto the action gauge. But on top of that, there's a power gauge, which I think if you look at the screenshots, there's kind of like a bar that kind of curves over it a little bit on the left side. And it says, uh-huh, that determines power and accuracy.
That's,
so I'm wondering if there's some kind of option where you have, it's like, okay, I need to get this attack off really fast, or if I hold on a couple seconds, it'll do more damage and it has a better chance of hitting.
It'd be like, maybe, like football, yeah, kickoff or something.
Yeah,
like,
that adds a whole new element to it.
Yeah.
You know, to charge it up or not, like.
There's a couple things that come to mind. The first of which is the way that they changed how Rangers work back in the day. All right, and as far as I'm aware of, Rangers, ranged, you know, being closer improves your accuracy, but decreases your power, and being further away increases your power, but, you know, decreases your accuracy. It's the only job that was affected by that. You know, as a samurai, if you hit it, you hit it. You know, there's whatever the formula is that determines the attack, and that's it. You know. Whereas in 14, we're looking at that for every single one. You know, if you hit it with a certain, you know, if you're too far away and it's just the tip of your weapon that brushes them, it does less damage. Or as you say, if you want to attack quicker, you know, you don't wait for that power gauge to go up. But if you wait longer, you know, you have more strength behind it. And the thing that it reminds me of is the Monster Hunter game for the PSP. Each of the weapons in there, and when I first played this game, it reminded me immediately of what I think 14 is going to be like, the way that they're trying to stress the difference between weapons, is that each weapon in that game is vastly different from the other one, but they all still operate on more or less the same basic controls.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, I do think that that's a very interesting dynamic to add to the gameplay. You know, because I think, you know, one of the things that the community got very caught up in with Final Fantasy XI is haste build and how fast you're attacking. Yeah. And this seems to be a way to, you know, not necessarily counteract that, but a way to balance that, where you don't have a single skill that you're relying upon, and it's your actual decision and your choice whether you want to be fast and inaccurate and not very powerful, or if you want to hit slow and hit hard. I think that that's a very interesting distinction to make, and I like the fact that they're giving us choices.
What it does is it opens up the pool for more skilled players than it is just for having the best gear. I mean, you know, nowadays, if you're a samurai and you have good gear, you're good.
Yeah.
Period. Whereas what this does is, even if you have good gear, if you're not timing things right, or if you're not making the right decisions, you're not going to be good. You know, it once again gives us, you know, the skilled players more of a chance to show off that they have skill over just good gear.
Sure.
Right. And I could see them introducing, you know, armor or maybe some kind of ability or skill that you can learn that'll maybe increase the rate that the power gauge increases or something.
Sure.
Too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
For you know, the heavy melee jobs. That would be something I could definitely see.
As you increase in a skill for a certain weapon class, then, you know, you're power gauge fills faster.
Or an ability that fills the gauge immediately or something. You know? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that they could do just with this one little part of the system.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, there are so many, they've really taken a lot of time to make an active battle system. And that's something, you know, from Final Fantasy XI, I know that, you know, we've all done this. We set something to auto attack, especially, you know, while leveling Dancer, you know, you throw Drain Samba up, go get a pop or whatever.
Yeah.
Come back and, you know, you're not dead. You may be at 0.5% HP, you know, 50% HP, but the point still remains that you can get up and walk away. This is not something that you can get up and walk away from.
Exactly.
If you're engaged in something, you are there. You have to be paying attention to be able to fight.
And really, it's the only MMO that I've, or really any game that I've ever played, to where you don't have to, you know, hit a pause button in order to be able to get up and walk away. Yeah. And I think that's a definite problem that needs to be fixed.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Another interesting thing that they had mentioned in FF14, you can draw your weapon at any time. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of difference that.
Because you look cool walking around.
Sorry
with it.
For mages.
Yeah, you're right. When they explained that,
which is weird because I can just imagine it now. A bunch of people walking around in town with their like swords out, and you're like, "What's going on?
Whoa, man!
Chopping down a tree with your sword just any old time or something."
Like, you're just walking around town and there's like a group of people you could totally set up like jokes on people. It's like, okay, when this noob walks around the corner, let's all draw our weapons. Let's
jack him.
Around the corner, all these like Rogadin pull out their swords. Guys, like, whoa, what's going on?
I wonder, really, like, seriously, what the benefit of that would be? Like, what, you know,
what the impact is?
If you can pull out your weapon whenever, you know what.
If you pull out your weapon in town, does that mean that you know, some guards are going to show up and escort you to jail for an hour and a half? I mean, you know what I mean? Because that was something I think that Ultima Online had a version of where you could actually I could be totally wrong and I could be totally misinformed on this. But as far as I remember, there was some kind of enforced policy where, you know, you couldn't fight in town, and if you did, guards wouldn't just attack you; they would actually, you know, hold your character up for, you know, an hour or something like that.
I don't think that's a concept that's new to
not at all.
RPGs at all. You know, like you've got like Morrowind had a system where you know, if you did something wrong or you know. you started hacking on NPCs in town or something, they would come and, you know, try to kill you or whatever.
Well, I don't think there's anything, you know, big or elaborate behind being able to draw your weapon or anything anytime. I just think it's some, you know, like a neat little feature. Like, for example, you know, you don't need, when you type /dance, to actually move around and dance. I mean, being able to do that, what actual benefit does it provide? It's nothing.
Yeah,
it's nothing but cosmetic. So I think being able to draw your weapon at any time just makes you look like a badass. You know, it's
just
there for cosmetic.
I'm just gangsta because I just walk around with my sword drawn.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, just in case I get like ambushed by dodos or something. You know.
Well, you know, one thing, you know, looking at the videos that we've seen out of Gamescom with Alpha Build is, you know, we talk about, you know, is there going to be anything that drawing a weapon does? We've seen videos when, you know, people target and engage a mob, the mob realizes this and starts to run away.
Yeah, I mean, interesting stuff there.
The AI is really boosted up from 11, so maybe if you're walking around with your sword out all the time, you know,
they'll
see you go, oh crap, and, you know, start running in
exactly.
the other direction.
So, yeah. That's very curious, because that could go very deep, like
one
with the whole improved AI system.
One of the first gameplay videos I saw was a guy chasing a bunch of dodos that were running away from him. I mean,
right? Yeah, he couldn't get them to hold still.
Yeah,
yeah. Interesting stuff there.
Come here, chicken bird.
One of the other things too to mention before we move on, and I don't know if we talked about this a little bit or not. You can click and drag parts of the interface around. You can scale the chat window. You can, you know, move the HP and MP bar. You know, they're probably still kind of tweaking that a little bit. And like, you know, I don't know how that would work on you know, on a PS3.
Yeah.
But you know, it'll be interesting to see just how, you know, how much you can move around and stuff. Because for me, when I saw the first screenshot of just, you know, with the interface and stuff, I'm like, man, this looks like every other MMO.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I liked about Final Fantasy for me was it, you know, it played really well because it was, you know, the UI was developed with console in mind, with, you know, you'd be navigating it with a controller. I liked the menu. I really liked the big chat bar at the bottom of the screen. You know, I've played Trials and stuff for these newer MMOs where the chat box is just like this little window off
the
side. And I can never pay attention to it. So, you know, if we can drag that across a little bit, you know, something like
that. Scroll it up a little bit, yeah.
You have to keep in mind that you've gotten used to the Final Fantasy XI format, you know, over the last few years.
Well, that's
so
true, too.
Anything, plus, anything that's different is going to be a little weird at first, you know.
Fear change.
Well, I think the biggest draw to the way that Final Fantasy XI did the chat box is if no one was talking, nothing was there.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like a constant distraction, or it wasn't something that was constantly, you know, moving all the time.
Yeah, that's right. That's true, too.
And we don't really know yet, but that, you know, that whole thing might be, you know, completely customizable.
Right. You know, because, I mean, if you're sitting there before a big boss with your Link shell, you know, sure, everybody's talking, but once it actually starts to get going, everyone's concentrating, that distraction isn't there anymore, and so you know that everyone's really at work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you guys want more information about the UI, we've actually got an article up on the blog that you can check out. We've translated a couple of the images released, so go ahead and check those out over at Orzopedia. Some other information that we got a little more insight as to how character creation is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Saw some emotes.
Yeah, some really cool emotes. Oh, yeah. They've actually did some motion capture. For a lot of the motions, and I guess they had some, you know, facial detail specialists or whatever that manually did the
which
facial.
Which is awesome.
They definitely made sure to make a point of showing the detail to the facial features, and I really appreciated that. That's going to be a nice addition to
a classic example of Square taking it a step further.
Oh, for real? Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. The one thing in regards to character creation that I have a concern with actually happens to be one of the things that I like about, you know, the direction they've taken it, the fact that, you know, they want to make it so that people who are going from 11 to 14 have the option of sort of continuing their character or making a new avatar in remembrance of their old 11 character.
Yeah.
I really like that idea, but I'm hoping that that choice isn't going to hold them back, and that they've taken what they have in 11 and expanded on it further.
I definitely like
the option of being able to do that. But I don't want it to be like FF11 again, where it's just like, here are your five faces, each one have two types of hair.
Pink. Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that you can choose. Skin color, eye color, hair color, different face types, whether it's, you know, going to be one of those, like, you know, you look at something like Morrowind or something where it's like you can change how big your chin is, you know, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't need something that in depth.
Right,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, definitely a lot more options, you know, a lot more options compared to 11. Another question that was asked, someone asked Tanaka, you know, are we going to see, you know, other playable races or, you know, Male Makote? And he's just kind of, he's like, you know, distracted and going to, you know, something else. So, you know, he says, you know, for now, that's like the status of them. So it really does, you know, seem like they're kind of saving something.
I hope so. I mean, it, you know, like Hollow, like you were saying, I think that it would be it would be nice if they expanded on what they had already built and decided to move beyond the bounds of the races that they had presented in Final Fantasy XI. I think that, you know, Square Enix, one thing that they do well is they create you know, very unique culture very well for individual races. I mean, you know, perfect example, Final Fantasy XII has a very multi-racial, diverse world. And to bring something, you know, I'd love to see, like a Sikh type of a character, or like a, you know, something like a Vera, or you know, they've expanded on these in other worlds, and I'd love to see them take the same approach to 14 and expand outwardly on that. That would be very cool.
If you look at recent trends too, with the way that Square Enix used to do updates for 11, is, you know, they would give us all these update previews. But then the day of the update, there would be like half the stuff that they didn't tell us about. And, you know, people would be psyched about it. And I've noticed recently the updates have been everything they told us that we've gotten. And even though they were amazing updates, you know, like we finally got the Outlands, we finally got, you know, the next rank of medals.
Yeah.
People were still disappointed, even though they got what they want. And I think that was because they knew what they were getting.
Yeah, so there wasn't anything more.
I definitely think that there's definitely a lot more, you know, that they already know that they have, that they're just not going to get us until it comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Right. A couple other things to mention about character creation. There was an interview with Hiromichi Tanaka done by Zam and Chris Morrell from the PlayStation blog. They got a couple little tidbits. One of the things was that they are maybe looking into the possibility of surnames. They mentioned that, you know, if all, you know, players come over into 14 from 11, you know, and for example, you know, you can't have two people with the same name on a server.
Right.
So what this would do is by picking a surname, you could still have the first name but a different last name.
And everyone laughs at me because my character,
you know,
is last
I would
name.
I would hate that because I wouldn't know what my last name would be.
Make one.
I don't want
Fusion
make one.
Space
I don't know what
X.
Be.
X would be your last name, man.
When I read that, I wasn't sure exactly how I felt about it right away because it was, I don't know.
I for one, I dig it. I think that you know, one of the areas that Final Fantasy XI really lacked in was this kind of role playing aspect, which is very very odd for a Final Fantasy game, considering, you know, that's kind of like what they're built on. It's, you know, they're a role playing, you know, that's what Final Fantasy is. It's a role playing game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though it's not the same kind of role playing as something like Dungeons and Dragons, where you're necessarily becoming the first person as opposed to a more fleshed out character. You know, I think that, you know, starting at Final Fantasy IV, we started to see this with fleshed out characters like Cecil, and then in VI with Locke and, you know, and Terra, and these, you know, Seven and Cloud and Tifa. I mean, you start to get much more developed characters, and I think that they kind of lost perspective from, you know, from the point of view of a online role player that would like to be able to get into a role playing aspect. And I think that surnames are a good way to kind of encourage something like that.
And I think
because it makes you think a little bit more about your character during character creation. And maybe that might make you inclined to take your character a little bit more seriously. Mm-hmm. Obviously, role playing is not for everyone. I understand that. And you know, I don't think that it should be something that's required.
Right. And really, it's not you know, Square Enix can't make people roleplay. It's really up to the players in the community. But they could also go to certain lengths, like, you know, some MMOs have servers that, you know, that are tagged, like, you know, this is a PvP or this is a role-playing server. So if that's what you're into, you know, come here and, you know, that's how you find other like-minded people and whatnot.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's a good point.
Last bit from the XAM interview, and we have this link too on the front page of the website, so you can check it out and see everything they talked about. They talk about the link shell system in 14. You know, they're asking them, you know, what are you planning to do with this? And Tanaka says, you know, in 11, link shells were more like communication tools. This time they want, they're trying to help players kind of aim for something by, you know, they'll be joining these, what they're calling right now, organizations. So they all, you know, it's players with some kind of common goal.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a little bit when we went into the community and the premier site stuff. They are looking to provide a website where people can communicate with each other. And, you know, so they can provide information and maybe, you know, again, you know, they said they were going to expand on something like the link shell beta. So you have something where, you know, you have organizations and, you know, this organization is doing this, you know, content of the game and this one is doing another part. You know, the issue I have is Tanaka says link shells are more like communication tools. Some of them are, you know, some of them, you know, you have like a social link shell. But a lot of them get together because they have common interests or they have these goals,
well,
like, you know.
I think what he means is because obviously, you know, different link shells, you know, go above and beyond to make an organization. But I think what he means is very literally a link shell it was supposed to be used as just a means of communication. And I don't think they really, from the get-go, you know,
there was no guild development system
which is
in a lot of other
which is
games.
Exactly what FF11 and obviously by, you know, FF14 absolutely should have.
Like,
From launch they should have had something more than just a communication tool.
It's a chat. It's a chat channel that you add to your chat bar.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's essentially it. That's it.
Yep.
That's
it should have had ranks. There should have been ways to see members who are members. Period. Members online or offline.
Yeah.
You know, and it's definitely something that 14 has to have.
Well, I mean, you can integrate things like point distribution systems and stuff. You can make some of that stuff
a little
automated.
Comment box, if the link shell leader could select someone in his little comment box that you can put, you know, player notes and such in.
Just things to make organization easier. I don't think that, you know, people who are going to organize guilds, link shells, whatever it happens to be in 14, someone who organizes that is not going to need any additional help from Square Enix organizing, except in just the bare bones software to be able to do it through the game. Because as it is, a lot of link shell organization has to be done off-site on a personal website, you know, keeping track of points and stuff like that is all done off, you know, off the game. If you can integrate that in some form or fashion into the game, it just makes things easier for the person trying to organize and run things.
And, you know, even if it's not necessarily in the game, I mean, you look at 11 and the Link Shell community beta thing that they have up, that came out, you know, quite a bit after the game was launched.
Yeah.
People already had established Link Shell sites and all that stuff. If with 14, this you know, organization portal or whatever you want to call it, if that's out at launch, more people would use it.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
That's definitely something else to look at.
Absolutely.
And another point on that is that, you know, Square is, I guess, worried about people navigating to external sites, you know, because they're, you know, they don't want to be responsible for, you know, content that you might pick up going out there.
Dude, for real, know. Yeah.
So, you know, if you have a system that's, you know, internal or, you know, through Square, you can avoid people going out to external sites for those types of things.
You know, I'm really glad you bring that up because it seems to be kind of a disconnect for Square Enix not to offer any kind of official forums in any kind of capacity and to say that, yes, we really want to try to integrate a strong community presence and a strong community site relationship. And that's all well and good. That's really fantastic. But what happens when you have websites out there that people are using and relying on that are getting spammed with viruses and spammed with password stealers and all kinds of Trojans and stuff like that. I mean, you know, perfect example is what happened to the FFXI Atlas. Everybody used that thing until it became so totally bogged down with malware that you can't use the website anymore. So, I mean, you know, how can you police something like that if you're Square Enix? The only option is to have, you know, to either, you know, be able to have the, you know, the manpower or the way to enforce that or to back up those community sites who, you know, I'm sure it's not, you know, the guy from FFXI Atlas who's putting malware on his own site. It's happening through ads and other third party, you know, third party advertisers. You know, there's, I mean, it, you know, something's got to be done about that, because this is not just screwing with people's accounts. This is screwing with people's data on their hard drives. That is malicious.
And the resources for 11 are, you know, that are out there, you know, we go there because we have to go there, because there's no, there are no internal systems that provide the information that we're looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and one thing to consider, though, too, to a certain extent, if Square Enix provides these, you know, these things that we're looking for, what happens to the community sites? If Square Enix comes out one day and says, okay, we have a wiki, you know, Ganyman is going to be over there going, well, okay, like, we had
what
a
happened
good
to our
run,
wiki?
I guess.
Right.
Like, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not trying to say that the approach that they're taking to the community sites is bad. In fact, I think that the way that they're planning or the way that they've announced that they're going to handle community and premier sites is excellent.
Absolutely.
I think that that's absolutely what they need to do. But I think that there should be a provision in there where they either back up, you know, provide backup for these sites, man, because, you know, we're getting hit hard. We're getting, you know, it's not FFXI Atlas's fault that they're getting spammed with malware. It's not, you know, it wasn't, what was the other site that
I think it was SomePage.
SomePage, yeah. I'm sure that the people who run SomePage didn't want that either. But, you know, if, because it wasn't SomePage at one point a sponsored community site?
I don't know if it was or not.
I
want to
say that it was at some point.
It was an underground site.
Maybe, in my remembrance, it was kind of like the page everybody went to until everyone kind of knew what Sam and the wiki were.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, when the whole thing with some page started to happen, like, the people weren't maintaining the site anymore.
That's true.
Which is even kind of funnier. It's like, it's a dead website. People are still going to it, and now they're getting hacked for it. It's like, oh my God. It's just, it's crazy.
But I mean, you know, there's got to be some, you know, it's great that they take a great proactive stance against RMT, but there's this also really horrible other side of RMT where they're invading our data and invading our computers, and that's not cool. And there needs to be something done about that. I mean, that seems like a problem that is way bigger than Square Enix.
Yeah, I mean, you know? there's only so much that Square can do.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
Talk about, I think, you know, it would be great if they could, you know, support these websites and you know, prevent that kind of stuff from happening. But when it comes down to it, Square Enix can't police the internet.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. I think we have to stay, kind of take a step back and kind of understand that these guys sort of, you know, had the opportunity to branch out from what they've experienced in Final Fantasy XI as far as the community is concerned. Mm-hmm. And change it or do something completely different for 14.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, I think that something that's really important is that community sites have to be responsible for themselves.
Yeah.
They have to be responsible for policing their own content. They've got to be responsible for making sure malware doesn't end up infecting their site. And if it does, you know, having a swift and, you know, a swift and public response, informing people and giving them the information that they need to be able to fight it. And right. You know, there are things that Square Enix has done indirectly to combat a lot of these things. And I think that the security tokens are a very big indication of that, a very big way that they themselves have been proactively trying to combat hackings. But, it doesn't stop the fact that, you know, these guys are getting into our data and, you know, it's not just our accounts that they want. If they can get bank accounts, you think that they're, you know, that's going to stop them?
Right. Well, you know, one thing to consider too when we're talking about, you know, people visiting sites like SomePage and the Atlas, and you know how people that have community sites should maintain them. I don't think Atlas or SomePage were ever an officially recognized community site either.
You may be right.
You know, Square Enix has always said, you know, when you go to register as a community site, they have an approval process. They got to check you out. They got to do the whole thing and make sure that, you know, that your site's good to go. So, you know, I think they've probably said multiple times, you know, to be kind of cautious when browsing the internet. But, you know, look at our community site page and stuff. These sites are good to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, if. You know, for whatever reason, one of their officially recognized community sites does, you know, pop up with malware, that it should swiftly be taken down.
Yeah, and if it's one of the more heavily maintained websites,
maybe,
you know,
even a public site,
once they get updated more regularly, if something happens, it'll be taken care of.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And of course, you know, there's a lot more about, you know, that's covered in this XAMM interview. And, of course, you can find that link from our front page at orzopedia.com. You can also go there directly. That's at, ffxiv.xam.com. That interview is up over there. So, definitely something that, is worth checking out. And definitely worth your time. So a lot of interesting stuff. Now, one of the big things that a lot of people are really, really, you know, kind of waiting on, you know, with bated breath for is, the status of the beta, when this is gonna, you know, move out of the, developer alpha stage and, go into the beta testing stage.
Right.
And some, you know, some indications have been given that, that they're setting a, you know, at least a tentative timetable for this.
Yeah, obviously, you know, this is what everybody wants to know about. It's the beta. When can other people play this that aren't going to Germany or, you know, maybe something like Tokyo Game Show?
Or Tokyo, TGS, right. Yeah.
It's like, I'm just going to go over to Japan to play a game for 15 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Tanaka said that the game right now is 40 to 50% complete. There's still basic parts of the underlying systems that aren't done. You know, one of the examples we have of this is that, you know, menus weren't available or accessible at all in the alpha build demo. You know, there's a lot of little tweaks and stuff that they have to do. He said that one of the things they're still working on is in the final build that the draw distance will be really good.
That's great.
That is good.
I'm really excited for that.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of upset when I saw, you know, the game is only 40 to 50% complete. I was like, oh, man, you know, because when they
look at that, though, you got to consider that most of that is probably that, you know, part of it is developing the Crystal Tools engine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, right. And then just getting the basic, you know, structure of the game. But once they get that and they have the tools done,
sure,
they can go right through it.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, one of the other things that was mentioned was they had been working on this game for 4 or 5 years, and you know, it seems like, you know, again, you know, we said this very early on that it's like, you know, already we're seeing a playable alpha build, and we just heard about this, you know, for the very first time out at E3. And Hiromichi Tanaka, I think it was Tanaka that this quote came from, he said that, you know, we had been working on this for 4 or 5 years, so to us it's not, you know, already, it's finally we get to show this stuff off. So and that's really cool, and I think for a game this size to be 40 to 50% complete.
Right. Well, the whole thing was is that, you know, I was upset that it was 40 to 50% complete, but he also said that people are going to be surprised by how much isn't completed when the beta starts.
Yeah, exactly. That's the next thing that I was going to say, is that they're looking to start this beta process very, very, very early. As far as development is concerned, it's not going to be a fully fleshed out, viable system. We're going to be, you know, well, not we, but those who are in the beta and part of the closed beta, they're going to be very, very much guinea pigs for how this is all going to be playing out.
And I think it's great, you know, when talking about the beta, Tanaka kept going back to, we want to get people involved with this as soon as possible. We want feedback from people that are going to be playing this ASAP.
Yeah.
And that speaks really highly of them. You know, they're like, okay, we got it to a point where we can kind of play it now. You know, before they want to do beta. They talked about doing a developer build and get focus groups working on it in Japan. And then they'll have, you know, after that they'll start the beta, you know, and they keep putting emphasis on they want to get this out to people as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really great that, you know, there's
so... Can I put my hand up right now?
Yeah, it definitely goes and plays into what we're talking about earlier about how it seems like, you know, all the pushing we did, you know, this last year about wanting to get involved and wanting them to use us, you know, they're definitely taking that into consideration and really wanting to get, you know, proper input on what we like, what we don't like, what works, what we don't think works.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I can't confirm this because in all of the materials that we have posted up at Orzopedia, I was not able to confirm this rumor, but I've heard a rumor flying around that special priority is going to be given to existing Final Fantasy XI players when it comes to the closed beta selection process.
You know, one of the things in the XAM article or in the interview that was mentioned is, you know, it's you know, XAM kind of came down hard on Tanaka. They're like, this is really, really similar to 11. And it kind of came out that, you know, they're targeting Final Fantasy 11 players. That's their first demographic that they're targeting with 14.
Because there's a pre-existing audience of 500,000 there.
Right.
That's great audience for you to tap.
To play 11 and then, you know, jump into 14 as well. I think, you know, it would work because it's, you know, a lot more casual friendly.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you got to think that this is already, you know, Final Fantasy 11 is already a 7-year-old game.
Almost eight
at this point. And, you know, they're still competitive within the top 10 as far as being able to hold and capture an audience. And, you know, with games like, you know, like Tabula Rasa and, you know, Age of Conan that have risen so quickly and then fallen just as fast. I mean, you know, you've definitely got to consider that there is that pre-established market. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of it is going to seem similar to Final Fantasy XI. And I think that is in some ways to their favor. But I mean, it is so at the same time unique from Final Fantasy XI right down to the very basic aspects of battle, which if you think about it is kind of the sort of center focus of any online role-playing game, really any video game. Combat is a main central portion, and for them to be switching that up so drastically with this game, I mean, it's just going to be a world of difference.
If you are following any of this information, or, you know, listen to just any, you know, one of these podcasts, I think you get the idea that it's vastly different. I think the only thing that you know, one could say, oh, this is you know, extremely like Final Fantasy XI, the only thing is the art direction.
The art direction,
everything
the races.
Everything else is so vastly different. But, okay, art direction. Well, it's the same art director. That's not really that big of a surprise, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I can't confirm that rumor. But I've also heard that that those that registered for the Final Fantasy 14 newsletter early on in the process might also have a leg up
I had also heard something else too, that they may be having a focus group sign up at TGS.
That would not surprise me in the least.
I don't know, but that shows you how quick this beta could be coming. You know, if we have the alpha build and like, next we have a dev thing and then the beta, if, you know, a month later after they show alpha, they're looking to do the dev build with the focus groups, that's, you know, we could see beta here, maybe even, you know, the end of the year before 2010 starts up. So
I think that is probably a very reasonable guess there.
I'm still standing by, people going to FanFest this year are going to get beta or going to be able to play the game. Like, I really
in
think
some form or fashion
in the FanFest somehow.
Yeah. And I mean,
that would be sweet.
You know, you've got to consider Tokyo Game Show 2009. You know, we're looking at September 24th through the 27th. So, you know, is it possible that we could see a beta launch very shortly after TGS? Now, I mean, arguably TGS is Square Enix's biggest live event of the year. And that leaves some, again, possibilities open, because usually we do see FanFest at some point following that. So I think that Tokyo Game Show is definitely going to be one to watch and see what kind of info.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, I think that we had speculated on the last show we were going to get much, much less than we actually got out at Gamescom.
Yeah.
And Tokyo Game Show, they're going to want to pull out all of the stops there, so they're going to be showing that off.
Which is really kind of weird. It's making me wonder a little bit, because from some of the interviews done, it didn't seem like they had a lot planned for 14 at TGS. One of the things mentioned, I think, is that it probably won't be in a playable format at the show.
Right. Well, you got to figure that Tokyo Game Show actually is a much different format from something like E3 or Gamescom, where you have, different stations. As far as I've been informed, Tokyo Game Show is much more like an exhibition from game developers, much like the press conferences would be, and there's much less of the sort of hands-on in the booth aspect at TGS. That's not so much of a focus out there.
Right, but hopefully, they can't not release anything 14 related.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have Corinth out there. Elmer from Zam will be over there. We're trying to get some stuff set up for coverage for that. We'll keep you guys posted on the blog for that, but we will definitely be covering that stuff pretty hard if anything comes out.
I think the more hype they make at TGS, the better, if the more they can show, the better.
Yeah, and again, I'm not surprised that they're being tight-lipped about what they're going to show out at TGS.
Yeah.
They were really tight-lipped about what was coming at Gamescom. We had no idea. We had recorded our first episode of Aetherite Radio days before before Gamescom, if not roughly a week. I'm a little bit hazy on my recollection, but it was very shortly coming up to Gamescom, and there was very little information that was released as to what we would see out there, just right up until the day of the show.
I think what Square Enix needs to do now that they've started showing the game in a playable format, they say they want to do beta as soon as possible. They've started that real strong flow of information. I think that's something that'll probably remain constant. I mean, you have E3 2 months later, you have Gamescom a month later, you have Tokyo Game Show, and that's kind of it as far as the big shows go.
Yep, so and then they're in the dark for a while.
Every couple of months, I think they got to maintain some kind of release of information, because once you get that, playable build in, people are like, I want more. I want to know more about this game. And so it'll be really interesting to see, how constantly they release new information for 14.
I could really see Square really trying to play it up for the Japanese audience too.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh
so,
yeah.
Because that was where it started, it was sure. The bread and butter.
It's like playing at the home field.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm pumped. I mean, I'm excited.
Yeah, I can't
sound
believe,
it.
I can't believe that they would give it,
I'm pumped!
There you go.
I do have a lot of trouble believing that they would give it such a hard push, in the West and over in Europe. And then give Tokyo Game Show the here's what we already got. I doubt it.
They open up in Tokyo. You guys know how we do.
Yeah, dude, they're gonna be out there in full form. So definitely something to look forward to. So that seems to be the majority of the information that was released out at Gamescom 2009. And, of course, make sure you check out our front page at orzopedia.com to read all of the interviews and all of the information that was coming out of there. Definitely some interesting stuff. As much as we want to be able to talk about literally everything, we can't. And, seeing that UI for yourself, that's something that you got to make your own judgment call on. So we got pictures. We got walkthroughs. We got little diagrams trying to walk through the UI. It's definitely good stuff. Take a look at that, orzopedia.com. We had mentioned last time we set up an email address for you to contact us, and we did get a couple of emails. Isn't that right, Fusion? We got a couple of emails.
Yeah, we got a couple of emails. We have one from Russ from London. He says, "Hey guys, great show. Been listening since early days of Final Fantasy XI. Quick question, are you ever going to consider producing a video podcast? It would be great to see video reviews and your character development during the launch and progression of Final Fantasy XIV.
I'd like to say, Rust, you ever seen pictures of us? Because we all have faces for radio.
Yeah, I can definitely say for myself that I don't do well in front of the camera. Although, you know, you bring up a good point, you know, wanting to see our characters progress as, you know, as the game develops. And you know, that's definitely an interesting idea. You know, something that is to be considered, though. You know, I know that we've tried to do video projects with Final Fantasy XI in the past, and one of the things that that really ended up becoming a problem was hardware restrictions on being able to do screen captures and stuff like that. So, you know, we got to think that this is a very graphically intensive game. You know, if we can get the technical aspects worked out, maybe that's, I don't know, that's
we
maybe
could,
something.
I don't know. We'll definitely consider it.
It's something to consider. Yeah.
I'd also like to throw in 2 cents. The fact that, you know, but between, you know, both people at PFA and LBR and so collectively here at Aetherite Radio is that there's a lot of strong, you know, radio background here, you know, whereas when it comes to things like video, it's not really something that...
Stig can make a mean thriller music video.
All right,
if you need, like, Lalafell's dancing, man, we can do that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, really, I think that's probably the biggest thing that's holding us back is, you know, we don't really seem to have any one person who's really into that field, you know, who's really made a lot of way into that particular branch of media.
And again, you know, a lot of the ways that we can do things like that are the, you know, the Dat Explorers, like... you know, Altana Viewer and stuff like that. You know, who knows what kind of tools are going to be developed for Final Fantasy XIV.
Right.
If it's, you know, if that's something that they're going to, you know, try to code into not, you know, to not be allowed or something. You know, you never know. You never know.
It definitely depends on the type of people that, you know, come to us wanting a hand in the project. I mean, you know, we don't really have a lot of artwork until people like Tam2 or, you know, PFA's Polished Tamales, you know, does the artwork for you guys.
Yeah.
I think it's who it is. Polish tamales. Sorry. Close. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
But yeah, you know, once those two, you know, popped up on either side, you know, that lots of, you know, awesome artwork started coming out.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think, you know, at this point, we just got to wait for the game to come out.
Yeah. I think
you
that's
know,
a big one.
If we get some good ideas, you know, we maybe, you know, throw up a forum post or something, see if there's anyone that would be willing to help with something like that. But for right now, you know, it's a great idea. Just, you know, won't be doable until the game launches. So we'll definitely keep that on the board, though. That's a good idea. All right. For anyone else that is looking to send us emails to ask us questions or comment on the show, you can do that. podcast@orzopedia.com. Jump into our forums, comment on the episodes, give us some feedback. Let us know what you like about the show, what you don't like, you know, if you want to see something change. And that's at orzopedia.com.
Yeah, and also, you know, we had mentioned that, you know, iTunes Top 20, throw us a couple of iTunes reviews.
Yeah, we are on
Woo-hoo!
iTunes now. So
yes.
You can go into the store, search for FFXI or Orzopedia or whatever, and you'll find us. So
yeah.
Give us some reviews. Let us know what other people decide how good we are. So.
Absolutely. So I think that that takes care of this edition of Aetherite Radio. Thanks, of course, for joining us for this episode. I want to thank Fusion and Steak and Kahlo.
You're welcome
for joining us here today. So thanks a bunch, guys. And I'm a Nero. And of course, check out the website at orzopedia.com. This is Aetherite Radio, the official podcast from Orzopedia.